Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here again for another episode. This is number 437. It is the first interview of 2024, and I'm really glad to be back here sharing interviews once again and doing live introductions for you. And I hope that you have had a blessed and meaningful holiday celebration and that you're all ready for this new year full of possibilities. I have a brand new grandchild who was safely brought to the world in the last month, and I had a really great month's vacation away from the work that I do. So I'm excited to be back and ready to go. In a few moments, I'm going to be sharing with you an interview I did with Amy Wright Glenn, who is both a birth doula and a death doula. And we talk about her book, Holding Space, on loving, dying, and letting go. And I think you'll really enjoy our very heartfelt conversation. But I have quite a few announcements before we get to that interview. Apologies for the announcements, but there's so much to catch up on since I haven't done one of these live introductions for a while. First of all, I wanted to announce, if you haven't listened to it yet, I just uploaded a few days ago a little bonus recording with Kim Clevenger. She is a casting director, and she is seeking participants for a new docuseries on grief. So we recorded maybe an 8-minute little segment where she describes the project that she's working on. And she's basically looking for anyone who's experiencing grief right now who would like to be a participant in this show. It will be televised. It's unscripted television, but each participant will receive counseling, therapy, and lots of tools for grief as part of the show. And so I will leave her email address in the show notes for this episode, but I'll tell it to you right now. It is griefshowcasting@gmail.com. You can write to Kim at that email address, send her your name, contact information, your story, and a photo, and she will get back to you. And she's actively trying to cast this series over the next few weeks. So do it quickly. If you're interested at all, you can have a conversation with Kim. She'll let you know if it sounds like it's appropriate for you or not. But if you're at all interested, do get in touch with her at griefshowcasting@gmail.com. Next, I wanted to let you know that on January 30th, I will be hosting Francesca Lynn Arnoldi. She'll be doing a one-hour workshop on her Death Doula's Guide to Living Fully and Dying Prepared. That is the January selection for A Year of Reading Dangerously, and Francesca generously agreed to give us an hour of her time, and we're going to do some of the exercises from the book together. And there will be a link in the show notes as well where you can register for that. It's totally free. The registration is just so that I know who to send the link to and also who to send the recording to afterwards. So if you can't make it live, you can receive the recording. And I think it's January 30th at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. And again, the link to register will be in the show notes. And you can go to eolupodcast.com, look for episode number 437, and scroll down a little bit there. You'll find all the links that I've mentioned during this episode, things you can sign up for and other things of interest. And then finally, I wanted to mention on behalf of Suzanne O'Brien from Doula Givers, a reminder that she offers the free Doula Givers Level 1 End of Life Family Caregiver Training every single month. And if you go to her website, doulagivers.com, you'll be able to sign up there for a free training. And so spread the word, let other people know who might be interested. If they're curious and want to begin this journey a little bit, learning more about the end of life, this is a great free training, a way to take their first step into learning about how we actually care for people at the end of life. And Suzanne is also launching this month the Good Death Campaign, and there will be more information about that on the website. And then I'll be interviewing Suzanne a little bit later this spring about her End of Life World Training Day that's coming up in April. So Suzanne's very busy always. She has lots going on over at doulagivers.com. So the last announcement is just I have so many people to thank who have made very generous donations over the last month, and I'm just so touched and so thrilled at your willingness to step up and to make these contributions that will help me keep the show on the air, but also helped me finally get a new computer that I needed in order to be able to do these broadcasts. So I'm going to quickly list off the names. My new Patreon supporters are Marion Folkemer, Monica Zaplinski, Jan Wiebking, Nao Sakurai, Chrissy Guerin, Donna Fleming, and Joy. Thank you for increasing your pledge, and Suzanne renewed her pledge. Sam Cash, Mark Langlois, and someone, an anonymous person, all three bought me coffees. Thank you. I love my coffee. And on PayPal, I received donations from Shannon Tolson, Sylvia Sigurdsson, Jaya Venugopalakrishnan, Leslie Morgan, and Laura Sirigli. Thank you so much to all of you. This means everything to me. As I've told you before, the financial contribution makes a big difference, but also emotionally and spiritually, knowing that you appreciate the work I do and you are willing to step up and show me your gratitude. That means everything to me. So thank you. We will move on now with my interview with Amy Wright Glenn. And as always, I'll be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go with the interview. Today, I'm so happy to welcome my guest, Amy Wright Glenn. And I'll tell you a little bit more about her. Amy is a Kripalu yoga teacher, birth and death doula, Dona and Inelda trained, hospital chaplain, and birthing mama prenatal yoga and wellness instructor. In 2015, Amy founded the Institute for the Study of Birth, Breath, and Death, known for its innovative course design and teacher training programs. Amy is the author of Birth, Breath, and Death, Meditations on Motherhood, Chaplaincy, and Life as a Doula, and the book we'll be discussing today, Holding Space on Loving, Dying, and Letting Go. She recently contributed a chapter entitled Grief Work for Teachers, Three Practices in Holding Space for Sorrow in a 2023 anthology, Reframing Self-Care, published through the Center for Spiritual and Ethical Education. Her work has been featured in numerous online publications, and you can learn more at the website birthbreathanddeath.com. So Amy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a delight to connect again, Karen. I know we had spoken a few years ago and you were so kind to share information about the advanced directive programs you do for Institute members and friends. So now the circle connects again. Thank you.
Yes. I was really excited to read your book and felt like, oh, this is a good time for us to come together again and talk a little bit more about these topics. And maybe for our listeners who might not remember our previous interview, you could just tell us a little bit about your story and how you ended up creating the Institute for the Study of Birth, Breath, and Death.
I'd be happy to. Let me just say that birth, breath, and death are thresholds I think that we touch every day. There's a new energy in the morning, and there's the goodbye to the day at night. And then even at night, there's a new energy that may open, you know, as we may make space for conversation or connection with people. So birth, breath, and death are woven, I believe, into our day-to-day stories in small ways. And sometimes the big openings, like the actual birth of a person or the death of a person or an animal, beloved, beloved non-human love that we may have in our family, these things can can turn the world around. And so for me, my world turned when my sister Rachel was pregnant and she sought support from me as her birth partner. And I agreed to support her, and we hired a birth doula. So that way I could, you know, have a mentor as I supported my sister. And those moments of watching her give birth changed me. And there was a moment where the midwife for my sister, she was a German woman. She just looked at me with her German accent and said, as my sister is delivering, you know, and I'm supporting her, she said, you would be a good doula. Mm. And it was as like a little arrow of wisdom was went from her words into my heart, and it brought tears. So that moment, a birth for me that I wanted to explore, what would it be like if I did this too, if I became a doula? So that experience, woven with many others, eventually led me through the path of birth doula work, hospital chaplaincy, and then a yoga teacher, something I've done. You know, I've been doing yoga since, you know, high school. I love moving and breathing and the experience of asana practice. So 2015 comes, I have a baby. I have, he's at that point a little older than a baby. He's around 4. And I have published a book called Birth, Breath, and Death. And I went to the midwifery conference in St. Louis called MANA, Midwives Alliance of North America. They had asked me to come speak and share what is common in birth doula training and hospital chaplaincy training. Like, where do these trainings overlap, if they do? And we know they're different, but there are also some really interesting synchronous places where people who are trained to be with birth and people who are trained to be with death or trauma or loss have really similar skill sets, I think. And so I went to the MANA conference, presented to a group of midwives, this whole room of midwives, about what I learned as a birth doula in a hospital chaplaincy training and where the overlap was. And it opened up this huge conversation where midwives were sharing how when they were with their parents or loved ones through death, they felt similar to how it felt to be with people through birth. It was so beautiful. And that inspired the creation of the Institute. And I thought, I want to be a part of bringing people who work with birth and people who work with death together in conversation so we can learn from each other.
It's really beautiful because it ensures that, for one, when we're focusing on birth, we don't leave out the reality of death. And likewise, when we focus on death, that we're able to remember birth and that birth is continually happening even as death is happening. I mean, they're two, as you said, two intertwined processes, and it feels as if they really do belong together. And you're the first person I've been aware of who actually brings them together in the Institute. And I think I read on your website that you do bring together birth doulas and death doulas so they can be in conversation with one another.
Yeah, just last night, I taught a course last night called Holding Space Consultant Training. It meets 4 times. And it's a course where people can learn skills or strengthen their skill to hold space. Practice in partners. What does it mean to listen to someone's story, to really drop into your body, to, you know, breathe with a person, to hold the container while someone expresses. And we have, and I put people in breakout rooms to ask, well, what does it mean to actually hold space? And I think we had 90 people in the Zoom call. And so there's like 22 breakout rooms, and it just randomly like puts people in. But then when I look at the bios of the people, you know, you have people who run birth doula businesses, you have people who run birth centers, you have yoga teachers, you have hospital chaplains, social workers, psychologists. So this random group of 5 could include people who are really embedded in death doula work or death work and birth work. And now they have time to converse, like, well, what does it actually mean to hold space in your work? And how can I learn from you? And where can I share that will inspire you? So just last night, the dream I had at that MANA conference keeps coming true. You know, I think of myself as maybe a host, you know, invite the best people you can to share a good meal, the people who most inspire you, and doulas very much inspire me. So I just get to learn with everyone. You know, I may build the house and people come in, but I'm not the only one in the house. There's so many wise people that come in and they share.
That's just so beautiful. And I was so attracted to your book because it's titled Holding Space. I love that concept. And I've noticed I see it coming up a lot more often. I would say on social media now, I'll see when someone shares something that has happened, oftentimes something tragic that has happened, and people will write, "I'm holding space for you." And I often wonder, what does that mean to the person who wrote that? How do they conceive of holding space? Can we hold space at a distance through social media when we write that down? So I wanted to hear more of your thoughts personally about holding space and what that means to you.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So in the holding space, I describe, well, first I credit the fact that I came across that term with the work of Heather Plett, a Canadian author who wrote an article called How to Hold Space, 8 Ways to Do It Well. It was years ago. And she described the experience of being with her mother while her mother died, and how the palliative care nurse was so helpful and brought so much love to that space. And she was able to articulate like 8 ways this palliative care nurse really was present. And so that's where I came across the term. And when I was asked by Parallel Express to write about my experience as a chaplain, I said, I would really like to entitle the book Holding Space. It's a term I'm using more in my work. And they said, awesome. And there hadn't been a book about with that title yet, so it worked. I define it as choosing to bring compassionate presence to what is, to the best of our power, right? So to bring compassionate presence to a story full of love and joy, or a story full of hardship and trauma. It means listening more than speaking. It means feeling into someone's story, not having to be right or wrong, just being able to listen to it. I don't think of holding space as the only tool we use in our human interactions. You know, if I was a surgeon and, I don't know, you came in or your friend came in with an injury, I'm not just going to hold space. I'll also like stitch the person up and use my other skills. But so I think of holding space as I sometimes describe it as an arrow in our quiver of tools. It's one more. And I think most of the time, like, you're doing it so well right now. You're nodding, you're resonating, you're listening. It's deep listening, reflective listening, with the intention I'm bringing compassion and my presence to this moment.
I love that you mentioned too, what is, because that's the essence in some ways of navigating all of life's journey and the ups and downs, is that we have to acknowledge what is, and we have to allow it, that this is how things are. I can't deny it or refuse it or ignore it. This is how life is right now in this moment. And so that's really beautiful to think of holding space at all times, not just when something tragic happens, but no matter what's happening.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the one time where it would be, for me at least, it was really hard to think about even holding space, was when I was personally attacked in India. I was traveling. I described that event and holding space in the book. I was young. I was 19. I was not harmed in the experience. Psychologically, I was impacted. And the moment that occurred, the last thing I did was want to hold compassionate presence for the people who had tried to hurt me. It was hard enough to hold compassionate presence for my own fury and hurt and anger and shock. So in moments where the brain and nervous system gets triggered into fight, flight, freeze, it's hard to shift that into the parasympathetic, like rest and digest, holding space energy. And sometimes I don't know if it's wise to do it. Like, if we're in fight, flight, freeze for an actual threatening reason, we need the energy of fight, flight, freeze, I think, to wisely guide us out. But if it's a trauma response, let's say I was on the train and no one came to me, but I suddenly felt very uncomfortable, then that's a great time to bring compassionate presence to a feeling, right? a feeling that might feel uncomfortable, if we can hold our own feelings with compassionate presence, I think we're able to reconcile with them easier than having a constant tug of war with ourselves.
Hmm. And that's bringing to mind for me the situation in our world right now, as we're recording this, with a war going on between Israel and Hamas, and we're hearing horrific stories of pain and suffering and tragedy, war in Ukraine also. And that sometimes, I mean, it's very disturbing to read the news and to hear these stories, but maybe those are times when we, sitting here safely in our own homes, need to be able to hold space for the pain that is happening somewhere else.
Right. And it's my heart's been so heavy with the news, and it's one thing to pause and like feel into it. And then it's another thing to think, well, what is wise action? How can I support, you know, do I donate to Oxfam, which is trying to feed communities on all sides who need food? Will I write to my congressperson? Well, you know, like, what action is wise? Because often when people hear pain, and if it's to a member of a community with which they identify, it's easy to then make that the person who caused the pain and their community all wrong, right? Like, I only support my group and your group is all wrong. And that kind of thinking is very common in human history. It's not just, you know, now. I think almost all war is due to feeling like I'm a righteous victim and you are an evil perpetrator, and anything I do to you is justified.
Mm-hmm.
And so having compassionate presence for more than just our group, or what we call our group, is a very intense psychological challenge. It's like, I'm going to extend my heart to people my community has named as enemy.
Wow. And that's really powerful. But for me, I'm finding, for me, not identifying with any one group, but just being an observer, I feel like this, like attempting to hold space in whatever my way is, to be with all of it, all the pain on both sides with a compassionate heart, is helpful. And it feels like such an antidote to being afraid, afraid of what's happening, or to wanting to just turn it all off and ignore it and pretend like it's not happening.
Right, right. There's another path. We don't have to engage the fight and develop a us-them mentality fully. We don't have to turn it off and pretend it's not happening. We can engage with an inclusive view that includes our own pain and try to feel into the pain of others, and then make wise action from there. Because my sense is, if we hold space well, hopefully the actions we take will cause less suffering. I mean, that's the whole goal. I mean, we bring compassion presence so we have less suffering. That's the hope for me.
Yeah, I believe that if we're able to hold space, we're more likely to act out of love than fear. And it feels to me like love leads to more positive outcomes, ultimately, for ourselves and for everyone around us, than if we get stuck in our fear.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't expecting to talk about that, but it's so timely considering what's happening in the world. And again, you know, holding space for fear before our fear of death, which is our ultimate fear. And I think most of us need to learn how to be with our own fear of death as well. And one of the reasons we don't talk about death and loss and grief is because of that fear.
You know that well. I mean, your whole work is devoted to supporting people in conversation. You know, when I interviewed you about the advance directive, so much of it was, let's open the door. Let's discuss when you're dying. What are your wishes? What makes sense for your value system? How can you think about it now, so you're not making huge decisions in a moment of deep, deep, intense, like existential intensity, right? That the decisions feel clear, as so you can walk into that experience with the support of your own heart and mind, having already laid out what you hope for.
Yeah.
So, it is a good question to think about. I know in Hindu philosophy, they call it Abhinavesh, if I'm saying it right, Abhinavesh, which means fear of death. And it's the theory that all fear ultimately is fear of death. But I sometimes wonder if that's true. Sometimes I wonder if suffering is more of a fearful thing than death. Because I wonder, and I'm not certain on this, but has someone been harmed or raped or tortured or severely treated so cruelly, I'm more afraid of that, mm-hmm. I think, than whatever non-existence or existence might result when my body dies. At least right now in the human body, that I feel like that scares me more.
And I hear that often of people saying, I'm not really afraid of being dead. I'm afraid of the suffering that will come at the end of life. So I think you're right about that. And maybe it's because they're connected, they're linked in that way. But that makes sense to me. And I was mentioning to you before we started talking that one of the things you write about and that I know you teach about, and I want to talk more about your workshop for facilitators, but it's about the idea of pregnancy loss, which I have a hard time dealing with right now because my daughter is pregnant. So I'm going through this whole process with her and awaiting the birth of a grandchild in about 6 weeks from the time we're recording this. But knowing that birth itself is full of uncertainty and risk, and that things don't always turn out well. Things happen that we are not expecting, and trying to be prepared for what could happen, while at the same time anticipating and celebrating all the joy that we hope and believe will happen. And you write a lot about motherhood and birth in that regard, and also pregnancy loss. So I wanted to discuss that a little bit.
Well, first I want to say congratulations to your family.
Thank you.
How wonderful, how beautiful this new chapter soon to open. And you're also touching on the shadow that many people lean into at times, the fear of, well, what happens if I die or the baby dies, right? And that does happen at times. So part of birth, breath, and death, the Institute's work is to consider when birth and death touch in time, maybe even death preceding birth, because stillbirth, the child dies before birth. So I would say in the Institute, those courses are the courses where most people have attended. Thousands of people around the world have trained with me, or people I've trained, to approach pregnancy loss with kind of like a tripartite or three-tier, not analysis, that's far too intellectual, but just heart-centered practices. So one practice is to companion, to hold space, which is what we're talking about, to strengthen our skill to have compassionate presence. What does it mean to show up in a hard moment, to walk in a hospital room, or to suddenly have an unexpected outcome or a death? Or even if a family knows that the child is going to die, to be asked to accompany them into that valley. So how to hold space well when such intensity is about to occur. And then the second piece is who is in the support network for the family. You're a huge support for your daughter. Who else is there for a pregnant person? Is it partner, family, neighbors, community, religious community, employment? Just thinking about circling the wagons, who can we pull on to surround and love on a family when there's a loss like this? Now, often with early loss, many people didn't even know the person was pregnant. Maybe only two people might have known if it was very early. I had a pregnancy loss after my son's birth, a few years after his birth, and very few people knew. I didn't say much. So that support network could be weak, right? It could be strong or weak. And then the last part is ritual, whether religious or secular. If you look at the, behind me is a little altar I have in this room, my office room. And each item there is special to me. And I encourage people to have places in their home like that. And if there's someone who's died that they really miss, to somehow have a place that stays. You know, my sister's there, and she had died, you know, last year. So to have a place where there can be some kind of ritual, like putting flowers or reading a poem or maybe getting a tattoo or dedicating a portion of a garden to someone. There's so many rituals we can do to honor. So those three methods, companioning, strengthening the support network, and looking at how we can employ ritual privately or publicly, have really made a difference for people when it comes to holding space for pregnancy loss.
Mm. That's very significant, and it's helpful to know. I mean, something to keep in mind, that we can all hold in mind three things and to remember to be there even for other types of loss as well, that we can apply those things, companioning, just being there and being present, pulling in the support system and the rituals. And I love that idea of rituals, and a ritual that I've used when people close to me have died is gathering wildflowers and dropping them into a stream and watching them float away on the stream. So I really cherish that idea of even having in mind certain rituals that we could perform, so that in a time of stress, we're able to remember it and think of it and pull together whatever we need to make that ritual happen.
Sure. I want to say to your listeners, and also just to you and for myself, to remind myself too, that it's never too late to do a ritual for something in the past. You know, I had a person take the holding space for pregnancy loss who does hospice work in Canada. She said, "I have nothing to do with birth, but I'm often with women at the end of their life when they're processing their story, and they'll bring up stillbirths that happened like 50 years ago."
Wow.
I mean, it stays with you when a baby dies. It stays the rest of your life with you. And yeah. So she said, "I'd like to know how I can support the elderly women I'm working with as a geriatric social worker in a hospice when they tell me about pregnancy loss from decades before, when we had fewer skills, and what was considered best practice for many communities at that time was to whisk the baby away, to not let the mother see because it's so painful. But then there's just this vacuum. And now we have a very different approach. Most cultures today have, in the U.S., for instance, we're a multicultural country, but we have a sense that it's important to connect if the mother wants to, or the family wants to hold the child, to be able to have the child's, you know, body in the room for a day or two. You know, some people have home funerals. There's a sense like, well, we want to have the parents do the first bath or dress the body, to do the things that they are longing to do with their baby, to take pictures. It's so different than how it used to be. And so she said, let me take this training, even though I have nothing to do with birth. I know. So I said, of course. And so I just want to say, it's never too late to try to imagine a way to bring a ritual into the present for something that may have happened decades ago.
That's such a beautiful thought. And, you know, maybe we need to be asking more questions about, has any type of loss occurred in the past? Because I still find that we don't necessarily talk about pregnancy loss very much in our society. It doesn't always get acknowledged. And some women I see feel that it's very rare. They feel like, I'm the only person I know who's had a miscarriage, you know, an early pregnancy loss. I don't know anyone else who's had it, but there may be a number of people, you know, who've experienced it, but we don't talk about it very often.
I know, it's so true, right? I mean, it's estimated 1 in 4, 1 out of 5 pregnancies end early. And so that's a significant statistic. It's not like 1 in 50, you know, and even that's pretty high. So when you look at like 1 million or 2 billion people, I mean, my hope with the Institute is that I can craft a space that's safe and brave for those who are called to be at threshold places. You know, those who feel like, I want to be next to someone when they walk through birth or death, or I want to be next to someone when they process the deep things in their heart. And so the Institute pulls together a lot of doctors or psychologists or professionals in caretaking, basically. And then my goal is to create a nourishing environment for those caretakers so they feel replenished, that they learn from each other, that they hold each other, that there's a sense of we're shifting our culture. We're bringing grief work out of the shadow. We're honoring grief instead of fearing grief. We're not making grief a pathology anymore that you get over. But grief can be a great teacher, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you wrote a little in your book about Alan Wolfelt's work and his writings. And I love the term companioning for grief. And if you'd explain to everyone what Alan Wolfelt means by that. But I just love that word and what it evokes for me.
Yeah, I love it too. You know, I have never met him in person. I would like to soon enough. I've emailed with him and I've read his work. He's been a psychologist for over 30 years in the field of grief and grief work. And he's the founder of an organization in Colorado called the Center for Loss and Life Transition. And what I admire about Alan Wolfelt's work is that he brings to the table a different paradigm. He said, you know, in much of medical training that he received, at least, the experience of grief is something you want to overcome. You know, go back to how it was, you know, you go back to yourself. But his view is grief changes us. We actually don't go back. I mean, maybe just life changes us, but there's not really going back to the Amy 10 years ago, right? I'm still me, but I've changed and I've grown, and hopefully in a way that's more resilient and I can reconcile with the grief I've known. And so his goal isn't to cure grief, but to reconcile. And he argues that grief is something the practitioner also knows because it's a human experience. And so rather than treating someone like a psychologist might treat someone with anxiety, when it comes to grief work, we companion each other because we both know it. We walk side by side. We like hold each other's, he's not arguing that a client would take care of a psychologist, but he's arguing that as a psychologist, if he approaches someone's grief with this kind of humbleness, it will help the person reconcile. It will be able to say, I've also known this. It's woven into life with love. And so to companion is to walk side by side with someone in a more egalitarian fashion to say, we both know this. And you're walking through the wilderness of your grief, your whole world just flipped upside down 5 times, and you can't make head or tails yet. And I'm going to stand next to you, right? While you spin out into all the feelings that come. And this experience, in some sense, the companioning person can trust that it may become a great teacher one day. But it's not our job to try to rush that process or push someone to say, oh, this is going to be great for you. You're actually going to learn a lot. This will be a great memoir one day. You'll write about your stillbirth. Mm-hmm. You know, no one wants to hear that. In that moment, you're just in hell, really. Everything just blew up. And so the goal of the companion is to sit in hell with you.
Mm. I love that. And that's just so powerful to sit together and be connected through our hearts and through the brokenness of our hearts. And there's no judgment and there's actually no advice given. Like, I know what you need, or because we don't really know. Grief has its own process and its own journey. We can be there with that person as they're journeying through without even knowing for sure what will happen next and where they will end up. And we're just sharing our own broken hearts in a way. And that's truly holding space then, that kind of companioning.
Yeah, I remember being with a couple in the book, Holding Space, the family when Harley Lynn died, that family, you know, we watched her die, this little baby, and then the head of the NICU was there for that hospital. It was a children's hospital. It was a really well-known children's hospital in the region. And she cried, the head of NICU. You know, she had tears streaming down her cheeks. However, what I'll say is she didn't cry hard that we all shifted to care for her. This is the thing about the support network. We have the right to cry when, of course, when someone we love is hurting. The goal, however, is to comfort in, and then we turn and dump out. So let's say for that NICU professional, this was so intense that she needs to then call her supervisor or a colleague after that experience to process. That's great self-care. If she had started to process it there in front of the mother who's holding the child who just died, that would be an example, like dumping her own grief onto someone who's actually at the epicenter of it, right? So this comes from Susan Silk's work. It's called The Ring Theory. She said, we want to dump out and comfort in. And so if we don't want to say the wrong thing, and we all do sometimes, can think about that ring theory, that we comfort the people who are closest to the pain. And then we turn, as we process our pain, you know, to the people behind us who are step back a bit from it to hold us. So it's okay she cried. But if she started sobbing, falling to the floor, convulsing, like suddenly the staff has to turn to her. Mm-hmm. And the mother then, who is really the center, and the father, they might feel like, oh, we have to comfort our NICU professional, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I liked you wrote about that in the book about extended family as well, who are experiencing the grief, but not in that as intensely as the parents or the people at the center of those rings. And the extended family has to be careful to not dump their grief on say the parents that are going through grief, because yes, they're grieving also, the extended family, but they need to look for their support system, as you said, behind them for their grief, and make sure when they show up, they're there to support the people at the very center of the circle. I love that concept. It really makes it very clear.
Yeah. And I don't think it means we don't show emotion to the people. Like the NICU professional cried. I think it meant a lot to the family to see her cry, that she wasn't just stoic, like, oh, another day on the job, your baby died. It's like, I feel this. This stays with me. This child impacted me. I have tears as I have my stethoscope and my ears hear her last few heartbeats. I am crying. That meant so much to the parents. So I think it's like we show our heart, but we don't somehow turn the stage where we're the center.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And that's a really good concept for our self-care when we are the space holders, in a way, the people trying to create this safe space for others. And I was curious about any other tools that you would recommend that we can use ourselves to become better at holding space and better at not dumping our emotions on someone else. And how do we navigate our own emotion in those situations, but hold that safe space for other people?
Well, I think this is a lifelong journey, you know, and there's certain skills that I've employed that have helped me with my unique personality and temperament and life experience. So what may work really well for me may only work a little for someone else. And, you know, like someone who does a lot of painting might find that painting is a way to process. And for me, I do a little painting, but that's not going to be the format that I'll use. But I would say whatever self-care method that allows for the power to hold like two things at once. I mean, think about the work of Marcia Linehan. She's the psychologist who developed dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT. And in DBT, you have this circle on one side of acceptance. You accept what life has given you, or accept what life is showing you. And then you have the other circle of change. Like you want to change life to have it work more effortlessly or easily for you. So these two things feel like they collide, right? You have to accept, but you're supposed to change. And she argues that when you overlap them enough, there's a place where they overlap called the wise mind, where we take the truth of both, that yes, we accept, and yes, you have power to change. And so I think whatever self-care practice helps someone hold two things that look like they're opposites at the same time and try to land in the wise mind spot will help us hold space.
Wow. I love that. That's really beautiful. The wise mind. And now, as soon as you said that, I would think, well, for me, it's meditation and journaling, because journaling is where I write out my emotions, but then I reflect on them and I learn from them. And that's the wise mind, is to not be led by emotion, but to process the emotion and understand it and utilize it in a way.
I agree. Yeah, journaling is excellent. And there's a lot of research on narrative therapy, right? So I would say those of us who are called to hold space professionally, I think we all hold space in life as people, to some extent, you know, hopefully we do it well enough that our families are happy and are healthy most of the time, you know, and there's always going to be some kind of conflict in human life. But I think if we hold space well, we minimize the suffering of it. But those who are called to do it professionally benefit from, like you're saying, research-based methods that help us find wise mind. Narrative therapy, we know that body-centered work, you know, breath work, so much being outdoors, less screen time, ample sleep, healthy food. You know, these are the things that keep the nervous system regulated, because wise mind is hard to find when our nervous system is in fight, flight, freeze. Then you have to actually care for your own nervous system first before you can extend a stable, resonant, responsive space to someone else. And for, through this whole interview, you've been responding and resonating. Even if you don't always agree with me, your nervous system is like really present. I see it. I feel it. It would be hard if you had just before this interview gotten terrifying bad news about someone you love. Your nervous system would be hard to extend to me when you're needing to extend to yourself. So I think we go through seasons, and holding space professionally requires, I think, a lot of self-care and even retreat time to make sure we are caring for ourselves too.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. So important. And I wanted to say, reading your book is actually really helpful, because you have a lot of tools and so many good stories and good resources and references within the book that, in a way, sometimes we need to educate our wise mind, about concepts that we might not have considered before. So I think your book is an excellent tool for that as well. And I wanted to ask you to just describe for our listeners some of the trainings that you offer through the Institute for Birth, Breath, and Death.
Well, thank you for your kind words about the book. It was definitely a process of love, a labor of love to write, you know. I thank you. With the Institute, there's some classes that are self-paced and they're recorded already, and people can just like sign up and you do it at your own time. It may take a year. You just do it, you know. And there's, for instance, there's one called the Holding Space for Pregnancy Loss Facilitator Training. And I co-taught that with a psychologist named Melissa Ming Foynes, who specializes in trauma care. And so we co-taught that, and we recorded it on purpose so people can access it and go at their own speed. And it's a 21-hour training set up to support people who feel called to lead or facilitate a pregnancy loss support group at their place of worship or a hospital or a community center. And so it's exciting, because when I get people signing up from Poland or Oman or, you know, Mexico, I'm like, oh, good. This is working. Like, the goal is that we train through this self-paced training people who are like, I feel called to bring people together on this topic, and I'd like some skill to think about how I'm going to structure that, right? So that's self-paced. And then there's courses that I choose to teach live. And some people can never join a live session, so they always just watch the recordings of it. Like last night, there's like 200 people enrolled, but 90 were there live. And that course I like to teach live because it's about how to hold space. And so I figure, let's do it together, you know? Mm-hmm. And in that course, people will partner up and twice. So let's say you and I are partners for 50 minutes. I'm going to employ the practices I've learned to listen to you well. And then at the next day, or we set it up where for 50 minutes, you hold space for me. Right. And then I might partner with another person and try it again. And then I journal about, what was that like? you know, what was it like for me to really just to go into this thinking, I'm going to listen to someone describe something that has been hard, and I'm not going to try to fix it. Mm. I'm going to listen and love. And at some point, ask them if they would join me in taking a breath, maybe put hand to heart, close the eyes, just breathe for a moment, just pause everything to feel where this is. And just to see how I can hold space to let them go. Because I think there's a wise mind in all of us that can sort through a catastrophe. And it may take the rest of our life to make some meaning out of some things, you know. I mean, I remember in my book, I describe that very sad day where the young man died by suicide. He shot his head, right? And the mother just wept in my arms. I mean, she may be white crying about that day till she's 90. I would, if it were my boy. So,
yeah,
you know, and I remember the surgeon telling her, if your son had shot his leg, we know how to stitch his leg together. But he shot his head, and we don't know how to stitch his brain together. Mm. And I'm so sorry. And then he looked at me and said, she's all yours. Like, you do your work. I've explained my part. You know, and the chaplain is the emotional sort of like container to hold all the crying, the screaming, the yelling, oh, it's so intense.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's the kind of holding space, well, which I believe you do very well, but I'm sure it takes some decompressing after an experience like that, to just kind of put yourself back together again after being there for someone.
I would come home and dance a lot. I still do that. I did that this morning and just put on some music. And now I've studied Bruce Perry's work on trauma, and he describes how rhythm is very helpful to get the brain to regulate after a traumatic event. You know, for me, what I'm experiencing being with that mom is secondary trauma. You know, that's what chaplains, they can burn out because you just hold space for so much sadness. You're just like, whoa, okay, I'm done. And so how do we keep frontline workers from having too much secondary post-traumatic stress disorder or trauma? A big part is to keep our nervous systems regulated. And Dr. Bruce Perry, who writes a lot about trauma, describes the rhythm as very regulating. So dance, drumming, singing, you know, I sing in a choir, you know, I join a group of 40 people. It's all a cappella. We just sing. And I leave that, you know, feeling really full of my energy. And so it gives me a regulated nervous system again. So that way, when I do my work, and I listen to my own pain or someone else's pain, I just have a deeper well to source, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That really makes sense as another form of self-care that's so important, or you would burn out, as you say, it's common because there's just so much sorrow to be held in our world.
I know.
Well, I'm excited to hear about these trainings that you have. I would love to see a lot of pregnancy loss facilitators out there, because I feel like we need a lot of support groups around that topic right now and ongoing in the future. So I'd love to see people come and get that training and the holding space training as well. So people should go to birthbreathanddeath.com.
Yes, you're welcome.
All about your work. Yeah. And your books as well.
Sure. I think for me, you know, I want to say that I try to create a structure where people of all income levels can access the Institute. So there's some courses that are donation based, right? And you pay what you can. And there's some courses where if you're a member, you have a discount, or if you have a need for a scholarship, I'm happy to extend that. So I do my best to make sure people have access. You know, I am a single mom. I've been in places financially where, especially after a divorce, where you're like, oh my God, how's this going to work? Right. I teach school and I bring these skills as best I can in the classroom when I'm with my fifth or sixth graders or high school students. And I write about the intersection of school and grief work for publications or teach about this. So it's really important for me as a teacher, as a single mom, as someone who knows what it's like to struggle financially, to make sure the Institute stays accessible. So if any listeners listening and you go to the site and you're like, this course resonates, I'd like to do this course, just email me if it's not something that's donation-based, you know?
Thank you for that, Amy. That's really wonderful. And I want to thank you for taking time to talk to me today and for sharing all of your wisdom mind with us and your beautiful heart and the work you're doing.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate you, Karen.
Thank you, Amy. And we'll stay connected, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
I would love that. Thank you. Right. And thanks to all who listened. Appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you. And take care, Amy.
Okay. Goodbye.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Amy Wright Glenn. This is the second time I've been able to interview Amy, and I really love talking with her, the depth of her insights and her wisdom, just phenomenal. And I wanted to emphasize again Amy's training course for facilitators for holding space for pregnancy loss. I feel like this is so very important, and we need more people with training in this area who are willing to be available for families experiencing pregnancy loss and helping them through that situation, that very, very deeply painful situation. And so I'm really thrilled that Amy offers this facilitator's training, and I want to make sure that you know about it so that you can go to her website and check it out if it sounds like something of interest to you. If you're already a death doula, you might just like to add this training on to your toolkit of things that you already offer. And so remember to go to birthbreathanddeath.com, and that's where you'll be able to learn about the facilitator training for pregnancy loss. So if you enjoy this content, please be sure to tell other people about it, share episodes with them, show them how to subscribe to the podcast. And if you haven't done so already, subscribe wherever you happen to listen, and then leave a rating and review, especially a positive one if you enjoy the podcast, because the positive ones help us go up in the rankings so that more people will see this content when they're searching for it. And I really appreciate that in advance. Don't forget that I have a YouTube channel. If you enjoy watching videos, you'll be able to see the video of me and the person I'm interviewing if you go to End of Life University on YouTube. And I have a second podcast called What Really Matters, Everyday Spirituality. That is just a solo podcast with 30-minute episodes as a rule. And I talk a lot about my own spiritual journey, what I'm learning, what I'm working on. And I'm currently in the middle of a 10 or 11 part series on travel I did in Italy while grieving. And so I'm kind of sharing little vignettes from that travel and how I dealt with grief and with guilt as I was taking that trip through Italy. So that's where we are right now. Probably for the rest of January, I'll be talking on that, about that, and then moving on to other subjects after that. So that's What Really Matters, Everyday Spirituality with Karen Wyatt. And you can find it on all the major podcast platforms. Finally, if you'd like to make a small contribution to help keep this show on the air, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support, and you'll find three different ways there you can make a contribution. And I appreciate that so very much. I can't even begin to tell you. And thanks again, all the new people whose names I read off today, but everyone else who's been supporting this show for the last few years. It really truly means everything to me. So I'll be back next week with another new interview. And until then, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings your way, and love each and every moment of your very precious existence. Bye-bye.